This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement. Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
20-year-old Stephen was on Christmas break from the University of Cambridge. It was 1962, and he was enjoying the much-needed downtime. It had been an incredibly odd semester, one full of highs and lows, both in an academic and physical sense.
Until that fall, he'd never been clumsy. But for the past few months, he'd often dropped his books or felt a pencil slip out of his hand for seemingly no reason.
Stephen didn't know what was wrong. He was frustrated, but decided to take his mind off the troubles. He headed out to St. Albans Lake to skate with his mom.
But once again, his awkwardness struck. As Stephen glided over the ice, his skate hit a divot and he went flying.
His mom watched from across the lake. It looked like a hard fall, but nothing too serious. Except Stephen struggled to get up. Every time he got close to regaining his footing, he fell again.
She knew it had to be more than just slick ice. After all, her son had been skating dozens of times. But now, his limbs shook as Stephen struggled to get back on his feet. Something was wrong. She decided to get Stephen checked out.
Later that week, they went to their family doctor. He set them up for an appointment with a specialist once the holidays were over. But he didn't have any answers either. Instead, just after turning 21 in January of 1963, Stephen underwent a barrage of tests while his physicians tried to figure out what was wrong.
After 14 days of poking and prodding, the doctors finally had a general idea of what was going on. They sat their patient down and told him the news. Stephen Hawking had a neurological condition and only a few years to live.
When our bodies fail, we trust doctors to diagnose the problem. But medicine isn't always an exact science. Sometimes it's a guessing game with life or death stakes.
This is Medical Mysteries, a Parcast original. I'm Molly.
And I'm Richard. Every Tuesday, we'll look at the strangest real-life medical cases in history and the experts who raced against the clock to solve them.
As we follow these high-intensity stories, we'll explore medical research that might solve the puzzle. This week, in part two, we'll analyze all the evidence and try to find an answer.
You can find episodes of Medical Mysteries and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Medical Mysteries for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Medical Mysteries in the search bar.
At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
This is our second episode on amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS. ALS is a neurological disease that deteriorates neurons and eventually leads to death. Last week, we explored how ALS was first discovered. We also looked at some of its common symptoms and explained how baseball star Lou Gehrig helped raise awareness after his diagnosis.
This week, we'll follow more modern scientists as they try to find the disease's cause and hunt for a cure. A key may lie in the mysterious link between a heightened risk for ALS and military service.
Stephen Hawking was only 21 when he learned he had a neurological condition. At that point, his doctors weren't entirely sure what it was. Neurological condition is a broad umbrella term that refers to any number of diseases or disorders that affect the nervous system.
Some are the result of a specific injury or trauma, like when a person damages their spine in a car accident. Others appear at birth or have a specific cause, like a stroke. But some of the most baffling neurological conditions are degenerative. They can appear in an otherwise healthy person and slowly kill them.
Stephen hadn't had a stroke, and he hadn't been in any accidents. And since his symptoms were worsening with time, his doctors concluded that he had a degenerative neurological disorder. The next step was to figure out which one.
While they waited on their test results, the physicians gave Stephen vitamins that might help alleviate some symptoms and send him home.
Even though Stephen didn't know exactly what was wrong, he knew that degenerative neurological conditions were bad news. Many were untreatable, and most were fatal. To the brilliant student, his nebulous diagnosis felt like a death sentence.
He didn't know what to do with the remainder of his life. He'd been a brilliant postgraduate student at the University of Cambridge, but he'd always found school a little boring. It wasn't stimulating enough. Now, there was almost no point in finishing. Why waste the few years he had left pursuing a degree he didn't care about?
Some noted that he began drinking more than normal, and the once outgoing Stephen became reclusive. His thoughts were marred by darkness, and sleep didn't bring any relief. He often dreamed of a looming execution and would wake up with a start. His life was quickly drawing toward an end, and there was nothing he could do to escape those thoughts.
But slowly, over time, Stephen learned to see the silver lining. During one of his tests, he noticed a little boy laying in the bed across from him. He'd been maybe 10 years old, and he was in the hospital to treat his leukemia. It was clearly painful. The boy moaned and gritted his teeth while doctors tried to help.
In contrast, Stephen wasn't suffering at all. Sure, he was clumsy and falling down a lot, but that didn't stop him from living his life. On top of that, he was as mentally sharp as ever. Whatever his condition was, it hadn't affected his ability to think or reason. And who knew? Maybe his diagnosis would be mild, too.
Unfortunately, that wasn't the case. In 1963, Stephen's doctors called him with the bad news. The condition was amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS. He had 3 years to live, if he was lucky.
Stephen's doctors didn't know how ALS was caused, and they didn't have any treatments or cures. But they did understand a bit about how ALS worked. So Stephen had a pessimistic roadmap to predict the course his life would take.
His neurons were deteriorating at a rapid pace. As they broke down, signals from the brain had trouble making it out to the body. He'd slowly lose control over his muscles. First, it would be minor, clumsiness.
But eventually, he'd be unable to do simple things like pick up a pencil. From there, the muscles used to perform basic life functions, such as breathing, would deteriorate, and he would die.
It was a dark future, but Stephen decided to make the most of the time he had, and that meant finishing school. A couple of years after his diagnosis, he applied for a research position at Cambridge.
But he could barely fill out the application on his own. He couldn't type correctly. His fingers shook, and he lacked the strength to push down on the keys. He needed help, so he dictated much of his application to his then-girlfriend, Jane.
Luckily, his credentials were strong. Even as his body failed him, his mind was as sharp as ever. In fact, Stephen had developed a reputation. His professors claimed he was one of the most gifted students that they'd ever seen.
Stephen continued studying at Cambridge and passed his classes with flying colors. Unfortunately, Stephen could never be recognized for his academic performance alone. He was always the boy with ALS, the boy who only had a few years to live.
Except the years went by and Stephen didn't die. The disease was still progressing, but not at the speed he'd anticipated. This allowed Hawking to live an incredibly full life that we could spend two whole episodes on. But today, we're going to be covering the landmarks in his battle with ALS.
In 1970, 28-year-old Stephen had been living with ALS for 7 years. He'd been using crutches to get around, but the previous year, he transitioned to using a wheelchair full-time.
Oddly, Stephen maintained a positive attitude about his loss of mobility. He wasn't even supposed to be alive, so using a wheelchair didn't seem too bad.
And just as he'd promised himself, Stephen made the most of the time he had. He was married and now had a 3-year-old son and an infant. Professionally, he was making a name for himself.
By the 1980s, Stephen was the leading mind in astrophysics. He found a way to reconcile two vastly different fields, quantum theory and Einsteinian relativity. He discovered a theoretical new form of cosmic energy produced by black holes called Hawking radiation. He even developed a mathematical model to describe the Big Bang.
All those findings are a bit complicated to explain, even to other physicists, but Stephen was uniquely brilliant. The media dubbed him the smartest man on Earth.
But there were a few mysteries he couldn't solve, like how he'd managed to survive with ALS for 20 years now.
It was incredible that he was still alive, but Stephen still had his struggles in day-to-day life. His muscles and lungs were weak, and sometimes he couldn't catch his breath. He got pulmonary infections frequently. In 1985, while at an academic conference in Europe, the 43-year-old Stephen developed pneumonia.
The infection progressed rapidly, and within hours, he had to be hospitalized. The doctors performed a tracheotomy. They made an incision in Stephen's neck and inserted a small tube to open his airway. While the procedure saved Stephen's life, it destroyed the ability of his vocal cords to work properly. He fully lost his ability to speak.
Luckily, technology marched on, and Stephen found a new way to communicate in 1986. He used a special computer mounted on his wheelchair. It could vocalize selected words and phrases. Since he wasn't strong enough to use a traditional keyboard, his device could respond to the touch of a single finger.
At first, Stephen might have found it disheartening. He couldn't even tell his wife that he loved her on his own. But with time, his robotic voice became one of his signature traits.
Along with the speaking computer, Hawking also used a mechanical wheelchair, since he wasn't strong enough to push himself.
He gained a reputation among his friends and coworkers for wild driving. Stephen didn't want to be seen as a stuffy old man with limited mobility. Like a reckless driver on a freeway, Stephen regularly dodged and wove around pedestrians.
His public persona was a little more formal. He didn't race his wheelchair during news interviews, but Stephen was very direct and sometimes came across as rude. Even though he needed a computer to talk, Stephen still had a quick wit.
In 2008, 66-year-old Hawking's fingers grew too weak to operate his text-to-speech computer. So his graduate assistant came up with a new way for him to communicate. He attached an infrared laser to his glasses. The laser, in turn, tracked small movements on Stephen's cheek.
Basically, Stephen could flex and move his cheek. The laser would track those motions and move a cursor on his computer screen accordingly. Stephen could direct it up, down, left, or right, spelling out words and phrases for the computer to read aloud.
Luckily, Stephen had enough money and influence to always get the most cutting-edge technology. But the wheelchairs and computers only helped him manage his symptoms. He couldn't stop the disease from progressing.
And finally, in 2018, it took its toll. 76-year-old Stephen Hawking died of complications from the illness. He'd lived with ALS for 55 years, 52 years longer than his original prognosis.
And even as the world mourned, Stephen's doctors were faced with a mystery. Nobody knew exactly how he'd survived so long. He hadn't received any different treatments from any other ALS patient. But somehow, he lived with the disease for decades.
And if researchers could figure out how, maybe they'd be able to develop a cure.
Coming up, researchers unlock the genetic secrets of ALS.
Now, back to the story.
In 1963, 21-year-old Stephen Hawking was diagnosed with ALS. His doctors gave him 3 years to live, but incredibly, he survived for 55 more years. Today, researchers aren't entirely sure how.
In fact, there are more questions than answers about ALS. But researchers are constantly seeking to learn more. If they can determine how ALS is caused, they may be able to cure or prevent it.
In 1993, an international research team led by neurologist Robert H. Brown Jr. published the results of an investigation into the connection between genetics and ALS.
Anywhere between 5 to 10% of ALS cases are familial, meaning that parents with ALS pass it on to their children or grandchildren. Brown hoped to identify the specific gene that carries ALS in the hopes that he could point them toward a cure.
He sequenced his test subjects' genetic codes, hoping to find a random mutation. You get 100% of your DNA from your biological parents. Every single trait you have came from your mother or your father. But on rare occasions, your genes mutate, and you'll have a trait that's unique to you alone.
Sometimes it's a result of exposure to certain chemicals or viruses. Other times, those mutations appear completely at random. Every cell in your body is constantly splitting to reproduce. And each somatic cell, or any cell that isn't a sperm or egg cell, is supposed to break into two identical duplicates of itself. But every now and then, something goes wrong. Some genetic information won't be perfectly copied. The new cell has mutant DNA, which replicates and spreads as the cell makes more copies.
Most DNA mutations don't change the way your body functions at all. They're called silent mutations.
Other mutations can be a good thing. They're evolution at work. For example, let's say you randomly develop cells with altered surface receptors, which viruses aren't able to recognize. You might get sick less frequently or survive infections that kill people who don't have those mutations. If you have biological children, they may also have cells with those surface receptors, and your family will thrive and flourish because they've adapted for survival.
But evolution is based on a series of random mutations. Sometimes they're helpful, sometimes they're hurtful. If a mutation is dangerous enough, a person will die without passing on their harmful genes. But if a mutation isn't immediately deadly, or if it doesn't strike until later in life, a person can pass along genetic diseases to future generations. Cystic fibrosis and sickle cell anemia are caused by mutations. Brown's research team thought that some cases of ALS might be too.
They employed over a dozen labs to sequence genetic code after genetic code. They examined the DNA of everyone with a family history of ALS. It took them months, but they finally identified a gene associated with the condition.
It was called SOD1, which encodes for the enzyme, or protein, copper zinc superoxide dismutase. Usually, the SOD1 gene, with its corresponding enzyme, keeps our cells clean. When our bodies convert water and food into energy, we also produce byproducts like free radicals. Free radicals are atoms that exist in an unstable state, and they can be harmful to cells. The dismutase enzyme, aided by copper and zinc, turns oxygen-free radicals into new, safe molecules.
The function of a protein, which is composed of a string of amino acids, is directly dependent on its shape. The final form of the protein comes together in a process called protein folding. The directions for this process are encoded in a person's genetic sequence. A mutation in a gene can lead to an improperly folded protein and, consequently, a protein that doesn't carry out its necessary function. It's very complicated, but you can think of protein folding like baking. You have to mix a certain set of ingredients, say flour, eggs, and sugar, and bake them at a particular temperature for a cake to rise properly.
The combination has to be exactly right in order for the cake to taste good. If you use a cup of salt instead of a cup of sugar, the whole cake is ruined.
That's basically what happens with the SOD1 enzyme when a person has ALS. The mutated SOD1 gene results in a protein that doesn't act as it should. The incorrectly folded protein fails to convert harmful byproducts in the body. Those substances build up until they poison the cell and it dies. When enough neural cells die, they form lesions on the spine, the telltale symptom of ALS.
Now that Brown's team had identified SOD1, they hoped their findings could lead to a cure. But they ran into the same problem that all the previous ALS researchers had. They still didn't know what had created the mutation in the first place.
As we said before, only about 10% of all ALS cases are familial. The other 90% couldn't say where the SOD1 mutation had come from, which meant nobody knew how to stop it from cropping up in future patients.
Today, more researchers are trying to build upon Brown's team's findings, but there's more to learn before they can develop a workable cure. In the meantime, other scientists are looking at past success stories for clues, like Stephen Hawking.
Nobody knows precisely how he survived with ALS for so long. Some attributed his longevity to the resources at his disposal. He could afford around-the-clock supervision and had access to the best medical professionals in the world.
But others think it had to do with the fact that he was so young when his symptoms first appeared. Most ALS patients are over 50. Stephen, by contrast, was only 21.
In fact, when people develop ALS at a young age, they tend to live much longer than their older counterparts. Scientists aren't entirely sure why, but some, like the University of Texas's chief of the neuromuscular disorders section, Dr. Jeffrey Elliott, suspect that there are different subtypes of ALS. One rare version that afflicts young people and progresses slowly, and another aggressive type, which typically infects older patients.
Of course, the main evidence for this theory is that young ALS patients tend to fare better than older ones. Researchers still don't completely understand the multiple types of ALS, and it's possible some other factor is at play, like the role of the patient's environment.
In 2005, Harvard University published a study based on access to information from more than 500,000 men in the United States. Between 1989 and 1998, the researchers tracked health and mortality rates.
69% of their subjects had been members of the military, while the remaining 31% were civilians. In fact, they noted that people with a military history were significantly more likely to develop the disease compared to the general population.
And the researchers had no idea why. They theorized that maybe these men had been exposed to dangerous chemicals during their service.
Of course, they could only speculate about what those chemicals were. Soldiers might handle any number of dangerous materials during their deployment. So the scientists broke down their patients' data by age to see if they could isolate the timeline of exposure.
They discovered that it didn't matter how old these men were or which war they'd served in. It didn't even matter which branch of the military they'd been in. Most had the same high risk for ALS.
This made it impossible to narrow down what chemicals the men might have come in contact with. And maybe that's because the answer wasn't tied to exposure at all. Military technology is constantly evolving and changing. It was highly unlikely that all of these men, from so many different military branches, international conflicts, and time periods, would have been exposed to the exact same toxin.
Since the chemical theory was going nowhere, the researchers proposed other possibilities. Maybe ALS was tied to excessive physical activity.
After all, these patients had pushed their bodies to the limit. Military boot camps are notorious for lengthy marches, climbing, and shooting exercises, all with minimal breaks. The exertion might have led to some kind of neural damage that opened the door to ALS.
In fact, a collaborative study done in Europe in the late 20-teens backed this up. It found that physically active people were 26% more likely to develop ALS than those with a sedentary lifestyle.
But don't throw your running shoes out yet. It's very unlikely your workout routine will give you ALS. In fact, the odds are about 1 in 50,000, and the benefits of exercise and living a healthy lifestyle greatly outweigh the heightened risk of ALS.
That's in part because researchers can't quite explain how exercise increases a person's risk factor. In fact, they're not entirely sure if this fully explains the link between ALS and military service. There could be some other unidentified factor at play.
Regardless of the cause, the Department of Veterans Affairs has set up a program to help former servicemen and women who are diagnosed with ALS. Additional grants cover medical expenses and home modifications, so a person with limited mobility can still get around.
For the time being, financial support is about the best an ALS patient can hope for. Every year, drug companies run clinical trials for ALS treatments. But it's deceptively difficult to find people to enroll in these studies.
Most drug trials only enroll patients who are in the early stages of ALS. At that point, it's easier to gauge how quickly the condition is progressing and to tell if symptoms have slowed or stopped. By contrast, researchers would have a hard time telling if their medication was effective for more advanced patients. But this means they have a very small subject pool.
There are also practical concerns. Most clinical trials run for years, and as patients advance, they rarely live long enough to see the study to its end.
On top of that, researchers need to know if their treatments are safe in the long term. There's no way to know what sort of side effects a medication or other treatment has if most of the study participants pass away shortly after they enroll.
As if that wasn't enough, it's incredibly difficult to even find a person with early stage ALS. It can take weeks or months to get a diagnosis. Even Lou Gehrig couldn't get tested quickly. Most patients who don't have any fame or access to affordable health care end up waiting longer.
That means that by the time a person is diagnosed, they may already be beyond a drug trial's threshold. It's a frustrating process for patients and researchers alike.
Although hope is hard to come by, researchers and ALS patients keep pushing forward.
Because every so often, miracles happen. By 2012, a man named Ted Harada had undergone a risky experimental procedure, and his results fundamentally changed our understanding of ALS treatment.
Coming up, researchers make a breakthrough in Georgia. Now, back to our story.
ALS has baffled doctors and researchers since it was first discovered in 1869. Every time scientists took a step forward, they seemed to take another two back. The disease is poorly understood, and drug trials are challenging because of how rapidly ALS progresses. But physicians kept pushing for developments, hopeful that something could change. They, in turn, gave hope to their patients.
In 2010, 38-year-old Ted Harada was diagnosed with ALS. His doctors said that he didn't have long to live, but Ted didn't give up. He read everything he could find online and talked with his neurologist, Dr. Jonathan Glass, about his options.
Glass gave Ted a lifeline. The Emory ALS Center, where Glass practiced, was holding experimental trials.
Before Ted could get too excited about anything, Glass warned Ted not to expect a cure. They were only in the first phase of their clinical trial. They were investigating an experimental procedure, but needed to prove that it wasn't too dangerous. Ted wouldn't even be receiving a treatment. He'd just prove that he could survive the surgery.
On the upside, if Ted enrolled, he'd help future ALS patients. It seemed like a worthwhile sacrifice to Ted, so he signed up.
In 2011, Ted checked into the hospital for his procedure. Researchers cut into his spinal cord and injected stem cells near the ALS lesions along his spine.
Most cells perform a specific function, and they reproduce by making more cells with the same duties. For example, one skin cell can split into two skin cells, but a skin cell won't naturally divide to create a liver cell or a muscle cell, and so on. But stem cells are undifferentiated. They can become any cell.
Undifferentiated cells are an important part of fetal development. Humans begin as a single cell called a zygote, and in the womb develop into fully formed fetuses with all the cells necessary to sustain life of an individual. This is possible thanks to stem cells, which can split and reproduce, and then turn into skin cells, blood cells, liver cells, or whatever else the body needs.
In adults, some stem cells may be able to step in for other cells that have been damaged. For example, it's very difficult to repair or replace neurons. When ALS kills cells in the spinal cord, those cells are essentially gone forever.
Ted's doctors theorized that the stem cells could support damaged neurons and stop their degeneration, effectively repairing the spinal cord. Maybe. They'd have a better idea by the end of the clinical trial. So Ted went under the knife, hoping to make scientific history.
Ted's surgery went off without a hitch. When he woke up, he knew that he had new stem cells in his spine, but he didn't feel any different. He figured that was a good sign. The surgery hadn't killed or injured him.
He stayed in the hospital for another few days to make sure there weren't any unforeseen complications. By the end of his stay, his doctors agreed that he was recovering well. The procedure had been a success from a safety standpoint.
After his release, he came back for frequent checkups. Everything seemed to be progressing as predicted, but Ted's body had other plans.
It seemed like he was getting stronger. He could walk unassisted and play with his kids without getting winded. He even discovered that he could go up and down the stairs at home, something he hadn't done for months.
But Ted didn't want to read too much into things. His doctors had told him the surgery couldn't cure his ALS. Maybe his sudden uptick in energy was just due to the placebo effect.
In August 2012, he underwent a second surgery and received an additional stem cell injection. Once he recovered, there was no more ambiguity. Ted's improvement wasn't all in his head. He felt like his ALS was gone.
When he went in for his checkups, the doctors couldn't believe it. Ted was no longer dying of ALS. He was living with it. He'd never fully recover, but he wasn't on a fast track towards death either.
Years later, Ted even participated in a local ALS 5K. Once, he'd been unable to climb the stairs to tuck his kids in at night. Now he was running road races, all thanks to the experimental procedure.
It was a breakthrough, but one success story didn't mean anything on its own. Everything needed to be repeatable. After Ted's surgery, major hospitals like the Mayo Clinic, Cedars-Sinai, and countless drug companies ran stem cell ALS trials, often with incredible results. Many people apply to get into these trials, but it's nearly impossible to be selected. There are only a handful of spots, and those can only go to patients who fit a specific profile. Like we discussed before, most trials stipulate that patients must be at a particular stage.
Meanwhile, some advanced patients are advocating for a right-to-try system. This means they can test experimental medicine without holding the manufacturer liable.
This makes for a tricky proposition for drug makers. The Food and Drug Administration makes it incredibly hard for medications to make it to market. When they let treatments slip through the review process, there can be unexpected side effects.
For example, in the 1950s, a nausea drug called thalidomide hit the European market without being properly tested. The medication was marketed as a miracle drug, and it was popular among pregnant women looking to manage their morning sickness.
But from 1958 to 1961, the UK saw a sharp uptick in birth defects. Hundreds of these babies shared the same features, short or missing limbs. 40% of them died before their first birthday.
Researchers tried to determine the cause, and they found a clue in the United States. During the same time frame, only 40 children nationwide were born with defects. Notably, the FDA had never approved thalidomide in the U.S.
They hadn't known that thalidomide could impact developing fetuses specifically, but they did know that the drug needed more tests in order to identify side effects like this. By keeping the under-tested drugs off the shelves, the FDA prevented a health crisis in the United States.
When it came to thalidomide, caution saved lives. But many ALS patients don't have time to wait for a barrage of lengthy tests. If the FDA drags its feet too long, people will die waiting for a cure. Alternatively, if a treatment is rushed to approval, there could be dangerous or deadly unforeseen fallout.
There's still no one-size-fits-all solution, but ALS research is still going strong. In no small part, thanks to a viral video campaign from the summer of 2014.
That year, people all over the world participated in the Ice Bucket Challenge. They filmed themselves dumping buckets of ice water over their heads, then encouraged others to donate to ALS research.
The trend spread across the globe. Over 20,000 social media videos garnered more than 40 million views. The Ice Bucket Challenge raised over $200 million for the ALS Association, which funds new research for a cure. And in 2016, researchers at a lab at the University of Massachusetts were able to identify another gene that causes ALS. The leader of the study, John Landers, directly attributed this new discovery to contributions from the Ice Bucket Challenge.
There's still no cure or full treatment for ALS, but there is some hope that within our lifetime, one can be found. Genetic research and stem cell studies offer promising avenues. While they have a long way to go, with some advancements, it might be possible for everyone with ALS to live a long, full life like Stephen Hawking. And eventually, with even more funding and research, one day, this terrible illness will finally be defeated. Thanks for listening to Medical Mysteries. Please tune in next Tuesday for another new episode.
You can find all episodes of Medical Mysteries and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify.
Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals like Medical Mysteries for free from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker.
To stream Medical Mysteries on Spotify, just open the app and type Medical Mysteries in the search bar.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
We'll see you next time.
Medical Mysteries was created by Max Cutler and is a Parcast Studios original. It is executive produced by Max Cutler, sound design by Michael Langsner, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carly Madden, and Travis Clark. This episode of Medical Mysteries was written by Robert Tyler Walker with writing assistance by Maggie Admire and stars Molly Brandenburg and Richard Rossner.